Dame Beryl Margaret Bainbridge. It's a wonderful name, and she was something of a wonderful character. I say was because she died in 2010, having been born 77 years before that. Now, she's been described by, I think it was the Times that named her on the list of the 50 greatest British writers since 1945. Now, I don't know if that's enough to kill a writer or whether it's encouraging. She was an interesting character because she started out aiming to be an actor, and she was actually in Coronation Street for one performance. But she got into writing, and that's what really carried her through. And she got a special Booker Prize for being the most second placed in the Booker competition. She was put up five times and didn't win it. So in the end, they gave her a special Booker Prize. I remember reading some of the early ones, and she was, you know, great fun and was really on the edge of being quite rude and
gritty, I think we said.
Yes.
Yes.
Because this is Debbie Heath with me again, and she and I are going to discuss this, and I've gone on far too long at the beginning. But anyway, that's the background. She was a dame, and she came from the hard streets of Liverpool. And as Debbie reminded me just now, she would turn up at plenty of parties in Liverpool, including those held by the Beatles and various other musicians of the time. Debbie, what comes across to you when you get to this woman?
I've got a theatrical background, so one of the reasons I have liked the things of hers that I've read before is that I feel, although they are obviously novels, they have a theatrical quality. I think the characters really do come alive. I loved An Awfully Big Adventure, which was made into a super film with Alan Rickman and Hugh Grant. And I suppose that drew on Bainbridge's early experiences in the theatre, probably being preyed on by these older men who promised her favours and things like that. The dressmaker I found very haunting, and that was more of a sort of mystery. So when you suggested this one, I thought, yes, I know I like the author. That's a great idea. And I knew very little about the Crimean War. So, you know, I found out a lot of new things. And I also found out that her style changed enormously over a period of about, I suppose, 30 years, maybe 20. She did seem to go for the historical novels.
Are you about to say the number of characters?
Yeah, so we've got three characters. We have the young Myrtle, who was an orphan. And she was adopted into a very wealthy family. And the son of the wealthy family, George, is our hero. Yes, he is. He is sort of a hero, anti-hero. And they meet Pompey Jones, who is a sort of street urchin, and Dr. Potter. Now, they all come together in trying to mask a big scandal. So they're quite unlikely people who would meet, but nevertheless they do. And the story develops from there. And it's a book with six long chapters, and they have two each.
There are these three characters, and the fourth is what it's all about, as it were, him, that they relate to and they play off and they talk about and they describe. And as you say, there are six chapters and they get two each. Mm. Myrtle has the first one, Pompey Jones has the second, Dr. Potter has the third, and then there are three more chapters, again narrated by those three characters. Each of the chapters explores the character of the person who's talking, because Myrtle, for instance, talks about her experience as an orphan, as a foundling. She was worse than an orphan. She was expecting to go into a foundling hospital, and then she was taken by this family. What I found particularly interesting was the nature of the individuals who are narrating. It comes across in the language they use and in what they say and how they describe it. Let's just listen to one as a starter. This is Myrtle, the foundling.
I was 12 years old the first time Master Georgie ordered me to stand stock still and not blink. My head was on a level with the pillow, and he had me rest my hand on Mr. Hardy's shoulder. A fingertip chill struck through the cloth of his white cotton shirt. It was a Saturday, the Feast of the Assumption, and to stop my eyelids from fluttering, I pretended God would strike me blind if I let them, which is why I ended up looking so startled. Mr. Hardy didn't have to be told to keep still, because he was dead.
After being adopted, Myrtle was brought up really as one of the family. She wasn't treated as a servant. They sent her to finishing school. And one section that I really enjoyed is where she explains why she always has to have dinner before she goes out to dinner. because her table manners are just so appalling.
I don't mind doing the washing. It gives me pleasure to swill the dirt from Georgie's shirt. That evening he insisted we took dinner together, which was his way of saying he was sorry for his earlier brusqueness. He doesn't usually relish eating with me on account of my failure to disguise appetite. The boarding school I was sent to taught me the right cutlery to use, yet failed to instill what he calls the correct attitude to the table. At home, if I'm invited out with him and Annie, he insists I eat before we go, as I haven't the knack of picking at food, possibly because I went so short of it in earlier days.
The three characters, as you say, there's the foundling or the orphan, the foundling. Pompey Jones is a fire eater. He's also not averse to nicking things. He's streetwise.
Yes, absolutely. There are various relationships between these characters which develop as time goes on. Georgie has not treated Myrtle particularly kindly in terms of his effect on her emotions, certainly.
And she's certainly infatuated by him. She'll follow him anywhere. As we see, they all go off together in the second part of the book, as it were, where they're all heading to. The second character, the second narrator, Pompey Jones, as I said, he was not averse to nicking things, but he also played games. And that also tells you something about his character.
Oh, I love Pompey. He's my favourite character. Bit of a geezer, bit of a joker.
When I stole through the dark yard, past the stables and outhouses, and lifted the latch of the kitchen door, I took my boots off before I stepped inside. It wasn't the first time I'd been in the house without anyone guessing. I did no harm, at least not of the lasting sort, and I didn't thieve. That would have been foolish and against my own interests. Nor did I ever venture above the ground floor. What I did on my dawn perambulations through the parlour, the dining-room, and the study was in the nature of an experiment. I moved things around and waited to see who noticed. I'd begun in a small way, changing the poker from right to left in the grate, shifting a vase from the front to the back of the mantelshelf, altering the order of the musical boxes on the piano top. Then, after a few months, I became bolder and swapped the pictures from one wall to another. It took 5 weeks for Dr. Potter to spot that the painting of ships in the river, previously situated behind the desk in the study, now hung beside the door. The resulting rumpus, reported to me below stairs, was all I could have wished for.
I really liked his point of view, because there was nothing stuffy about it. Dr. Potter is harder to like, really, isn't he?
It was a sort of Dickensian professorial character. Yeah. You can almost hear the commas going in his brain as he says, as I would have said, comma.
Yes.
And you can sense that in the language, the way he speaks.
The Cambria was crowded to the extent that we wallowed below the waterline, there being 200 troopers on board, 4 engineers, a veterinary surgeon, and a representative of the Liverpool Board of Commerce, sent out to see what supplies might most be in need of urgent shipment should war commence. It is the patriotic duty of the citizens of Liverpool, this gentleman informed me at the first opportunity, to make whatever sacrifices necessary in support of our army. His name was Norton, and a more odious and obsequious individual could not be imagined. I had several heated conversations with him during the course of the voyage, and formed the opinion that profit rather than patriotism ignited his sense of duty. We were fortunate in the weather on the first leg of our journey to Malta. Nothing of note happened in the first 3 days, save for the ship's collie producing 8 pups. Myrtle insisted on earmarking one, the runt of the litter, for the children. It would be good for them, she declared, to be responsible for something small and helpless. That same afternoon, a so-called wife of one of the troopers gave birth to an infant daughter. Thankfully, it died 3 hours later, else Myrtle might have added it to our list of dependents.
Again, this comes back to the theatrical undertones, doesn't it? You really can hear him speak. If you can hear him think, it's amazing as well. So, yeah, these three very well-defined characters are used. Now, as a listener, I did not pick up on the fact that each of the six chapters is supposed to represent a photograph.
Any novelist writing about a historical fact will have done research, and I'm certain she came across the great photographer of the 19th century, Fenton. I cannot remember his first name for the moment, but I remember his name was Fenton, and he was the first war photographer. Now, he went out to the Crimea War, 1850s, and he took photographs not of action, battle action, and not of dead bodies, but of soldiers standing portraits almost. And that was the first time that people back home, because it had been artists who drew what they saw.
Or did they actually draw what they saw?
draw what they were supposed to see. But even so, I say he wasn't photographing the action, he was photographing these. But it showed much more of the grit, the unpleasantness, the dirt, the pain of war, because you would have seen things like bandages and hospital wagons.
Yeah, but not so much that no. They could no longer recruit people, I suppose.
That's right. But anyway, the photography is relevant because George, who is a surgeon...
He's a surgeon by profession, but he's an amateur photographer,
That's
isn't
right.
he?
And so he combines those two, and his aim is to go out to the Crimea War to do both jobs. I mean, he does both jobs. He's trying to take photographs at the same time as he's trying to be a surgeon. As we know from Florence Nightingale, etc., it was a pretty horrendous situation, and a surgeon would have been much needed. And that's where the book leads us, the story leads us, the journey out there, the stop at Constantinople, as it was then called, Istanbul, the route out to the place called Crimea, about which we now know a great deal more, because of course it's right at the heart of the current war in the Ukraine. Some critics suggest that having three narrators, which is not unusual, but it's a very good and interesting way to create characters, because they, to some extent, play off against each other, but they also describe events in slightly different ways, because no two of us ever experience the same
things
about the situation that we are in.
And it's really like looking at a photograph, isn't it? This is a photograph that they are describing, but they see it different ways. And the other advantage is, of course, if you don't particularly like one narrator, you won't have to wait long till there's someone else. It's a structure I really like in a book, like The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins. I love the way that narration skips about. But I think it's got the added significance here, hasn't it, of the photograph and people interpreting what they see in different ways and what is truth. Because, of course, the photographer wouldn't be photographing, as you said, the real action. So, you know, you could write a great essay on this, couldn't you? A-level English literature. There's a lot that you could say, but we don't have time for that. And it's a long time since I did A-level English literature, so I don't think I could anyway.
Me even more so. And as we said, it takes us into the Crimean War, and we're not going to go into that section because that should be left to the listener to enjoy without knowing what's going to happen. And there are various things that happen, obviously, but it is a war. War is nasty. War is unpleasant. War is violent. And she doesn't pull her punches in many ways. And it takes us from the back streets of Liverpool out to Sebastopol and Inkerman and these other famous great names of the Crimean War. I mean, it was a dreadful war. It was one of the worst wars.
Yes, supposed to be one of the bloodiest.
I refer to Florence Nightingale, sort of. That's what the picture we get is this wonderful woman going out there setting up nursing. But I mean, she walked into hell. It was hell on earth.
Yes, indeed. And some of the other characters, the secondary characters, they don't get much further than the boat. The journey section really stuck with me. And I thought, yes, I probably would have been like those women and just wanted to go home. This would not work out for me.
Because in the charge of the Light Brigade, the troops were followed by the cavalcade of wagons, which brought the women, the wives, the mistresses, the hangers-on, the prostitutes, the cooks, everybody, all came behind the army. Disease was rampant and it was not a good thing to do.
So, I mean, this is a really relevant book for us to have read at this point because of the links to the current war and disease. We've got still got COVID, haven't we? So it's a really interesting time to read the book.
I hope we make it sound fun as well as that last bit about the war, as it were. But it actually has got some characters that are just wonderful to explore.
Yes, absolutely. So I suppose if I was giving the reader three reasons why they should pick it up, one, I would say, well, it's short. And like me, when you listen to audiobooks, if you don't have... Well, actually, it's not just people who are sight impaired. Lots of people now choose to listen to audiobooks. You're investing a lot of time in something that's 20 hours long. This was 6 hours, and it's just so beautifully written. It's not a sketch. It's a really well-developed character piece. So that's our second point. The characterisation is superb. And the third point is you just might find out something you didn't know about the Crimean War.
As you said, it's 6 hours long. The recording is by Nancy Clegg for Calibre. They have a couple of other novels by Beryl Bainbridge, Every Man for Himself, which is based on the Titanic, and one that Debbie mentioned a couple of times, An Awfully Big Adventure, which is one that I remember reading with great pleasure. And it's about the theatre, and it's about actors, and it's, again, full of characters, full of fun, as yeah. well as serious
intent.
She does
intent. Have... Isn't it extraordinary that you can find fun in one of the most unpleasant war situations? She's very skilled, and she doesn't take the mickey out of it either. It's just that in everyday life, there are funny things that happen, and that's what keeps you going.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.